But my name is Sam Hilliard, and I hail from Northeast Georgia. At the moment, though, my brain has been turned to cornmeal mush, or maybe I should say garlic grits, because every speaker that gets up makes me want to rewrite the paper that I had intended. Now, considering it's been going for 2 days, you can imagine how my brain is reeling at the moment. But the last speaker, of course, was a treasure, was she not? I think we ought to elevate her. Put a raised platform over here and label her incredible resource. And let her stay there for as long as she'd like. It reminds me that, you know, occasionally we're seduced into doing administration. And I was given some very good advice. One person said, the best advice for an administrator is to choose your successor and your predecessor very carefully. Unfortunately, and I blame you for this, I had no control over the matter. But it was a delight. I do have something to say about okra, though. I did graduate work for the PhD, that is, at the University of Wisconsin. And it was back, well, in 1960 or so, and it was sort of the beginning of the Back to the Earth movement. And the university had a little field near graduate housing, and it chopped it up into square 25 feet by 25 foot plots. Obviously, in the Midwest, you have to go with the township and range square system. And then they fertilized it, plowed it, and then they rented each square to us for $1. Well, there's a real challenge in that. What do you do in a 25 by 25 foot plot? And guess what we planted? We planted okra. And it was the marvel of the whole thing. People came around. We'd go out there sometimes to work it on the few times that we did, and the people would be around the plot looking at it, wondering what it was. It was also a good exercise in differential agriculture from one part of the country or world to the other. We had a graduate student from Arizona, and he was used to irrigated agriculture, so he and his wife went to great trouble mounding up the earth in rows, and then he planted on the bottom in the furrow, because I guess he assumed there'd be a drought and he needed all the water he could get. There was a graduate student in physics from Mississippi, believe it or not. He came back and went to Mississippi State, but at any rate, he and his wife went out, well, he did all the work, she didn't. I don't know how that came to be, though. But anyway, he mounded it up just like the guy did from Arizona, but he planted in the top. The guy from Arizona planted in the bottom. There was a graduate student from Jamaica, and they built a round mound of earth and then planted the plants around that, as they do in the Caribbean. And, of course, being a redneck from Georgia, I planted it very carefully and then let the crabgrass eat it up. But anyway, back to this idea of my brain being befuddled. It all started with Pete Daniel. Pete Daniel began talking about Henry Wallace and people from Iowa not knowing anything about Southern agriculture. It's really quite true. No truer words have been spoken. And it still exists. In fact, it's infected the South. Southerners oftentimes think like non-Southerners now about themselves. And 2 or 3 weeks ago, I went to one of these festivals called Mule Day in Washington, Georgia. There are all kinds of mule days. The granddaddy of all of them, I think, is Columbia, Tennessee, where the mules from the Midwest moved into the South, even back into the antebellum period. And they were plowing with mules that I had never seen in my life. They were huge mules, and they were heavy, 1,200, 1,400 pounds. They looked like the draft horses in the Midwest, not like the mules that I knew when I was growing up in the South. Little scrawny things that weighed 600 or 700 pounds. But not only that, they had them harnessed in harnesses that came out of the whip. They looked like the Budweiser draft horses. They didn't look like mules. And yet they were pretending that they were a museum in preserving Southern culture. They preserve Southern culture by destroying it and replacing it with another culture. But and then, of course, yesterday, Lou Ann Jones started talking about marketing eggs and things like that. And she hit my childhood so completely square on the mark. Is she here today? I almost stood up and say, Hank Williams, you wrote my life. Every store that I ever went into as a child had a box, and it was filled with cottonseed meal hulls. You know the difference between meal and hulls. And that was where you put the eggs because they didn't break. And there's one thing I wanted to ask you, but so many people were crowded around you. Have you ever heard of the chicken car? We had a chicken car that came to town, and it was, I think, maybe a cattle car because it was a railroad car, and it had slats and a door and steps, and you go up in there, and there were chicken coops all in rows along that car. And the local newspaper would tell what day it was in your town. And in Bowersville, like it was on Tuesday, I believe, and the train would bring in the car early in the morning, drop it, go on its way, and come back and pick it up that night. And all the people in the community would bring their chickens into that. And they would sell them. And I remember that they would transport the chickens. They would get a, you know what a croaker sack is? Some people call them burlap bags. You cut a little hole. You cut a little hole, and the chicken's neck goes through that. And you'll see a person walking down the road, and there'll be five or six chicken necks stuck out. And when I went to Africa, guess what I saw? I saw people walking around with those bags over their back with chicken necks sticking out everywhere. And I wonder, you know, having been associated with anthropologists for a long time, was that a case of parallel invention or diffusion? But at any rate, you can understand why I am confused. But maybe out of confusion will come something worthwhile. Let's try it anyway. When I was asked by John to join this group, naturally I wanted to know, since I'm retired now and not actively engaged in research, although I do write a column for the newspaper, what shall I talk about? Normally I go to talk about what I'm doing. And he said, well, I'm curious about hog meat and hoe cake. And I said, well, it's been around for quite a while. And he says, no, I want you to elaborate on that. So I said, okay. And I had everything all outlined. And then I got this thing right here. And once again, my brain went into a tizzy. I looked at all of you people, or at least the ones who are on the program, what you do for a living. And I said, good heavens, they probably never heard of hog meat and hoe cake. So maybe I better rethink what I'm going to do. So I thought perhaps that I better start with an introduction of myself. So I thought I would do Hog Meat and Hoe Cake. No, that's not a good title. I think then after Madam Hess's talk, I'll call my paper today The Confessions of a Former Bean Counter. So with that in mind, let's talk about who I am and where I came from. I told you I grew up in northeast Georgia. That's not down in the coastal plain. It's well into the Piedmont. To give you some idea of where it is, if you know where Interstate 85 is, I live within 10 miles of South Carolina and about 10 miles of Interstate 85. I left home, served the Navy for a while, and worked as an electrician. Now, what relevance that has, I have no idea. But I became restless and went back to school and did a Bachelor of Arts, not science, but a Bachelor of Arts at the University of Georgia and a Master. And then I went off to the University of Wisconsin, a young boy from Georgia with great trepidations about what was going to happen to me up in those areas. I was as frightened, I think, going to Wisconsin as some of the freedom riders were coming into Mississippi. It was not a pleasant experience, but I'm happy to say that I was received much better up there. It was an enjoyable time. But when I was at Georgia, I worked with a man by the name of Merle Prunty, Jr. Some of you know his work. Any of you, if you've ever dealt with plantations, he's done things with plantations. He was a geographer. I did a minor in history, but he was a geographer. He was of a kind of geographer that I would describe as a spatial geographer. Sometimes my colleagues referred to them as spaced out geographers. But it was in those times when people began to think of distance as being very important. That is, if towns are close together, there'd be a great deal of interchange if they're farther apart. Some Germans during an earlier period by the name of von Thunen did what was called the von Thunen model. And then another one by the name of Kristaller did central place theory. And so that space and distance became very important. Before that, geography had been sort of environmental and, you know, locational. And this was a real breakthrough. But at any rate, that's where it was going at the time I entered. It also dealt a great deal with maps. You produce maps, you look at maps, and sometimes you can take things and map them and see relations or correlations between them. And so that was about the time I entered. Some examples of that kind of thing would have been mentioned since I've been here. For example, we talked about the Okra line. Well, that's eminently geographic. And there's another one that you've heard of called the Grits Hash Brown line. Have you ever heard of that one? And then if you have anything to do with making sandwiches, you've heard of the mayonnaise butter line, haven't you? Well, a lot of my colleagues talk about that thing, those things like that a lot. I guess the nearest thing I've ever done to that was a friend of mine at LSU and I got together, and we noted that people, that places where you go, they serve you tomatoes for breakfast, along with, and so we began working on that in a very, very informal way. And we'd travel and we'd get one of these huge maps, 1 to 5 million, that shows every county. And if you had tomatoes served, you put a dot on the map. And pretty soon we knew where the tomatoes for breakfast line. It wasn't a line, it was a zone. It stretched from maybe old Richmond, Virginia, to Texarkana, about maybe 50 miles on each side of that line, roughly corresponding to what I refer to as the white light bright belt. You know what that is? See, when you have wheat bread that's sifted and it's white, you call it white bread, or you call it light bread. It's a way of pronouncing the word, and it's universal for that particular area. Well, after that, being immersed in that, I went off to the University of Wisconsin and studied under a man by the name of Andrew Clark, who was a Canadian. His undergraduate was in math, believe it or not. So I've had a double dose of that. But he did a master's in history and later a PhD at Berkeley. And he sent me to the economic historians. So most of the history I've had is economic history. I worked with a guy named Eric Lampard, Vernon Carstensen, and Morton Rothstein was my minor professor. And of course, then I went to LSU, a fateful decision to go to LSU. And in the words of Jerry Clower, I was never the same after going to LSU. I don't know where all of a sudden hog meat and hoe cake became gumbo and rice or something, but I've never been the same. There was a man there, and I say was, he died the year I retired, having been born in the year 1900. He went to LSU before I was born, and he was a real treasure, and I learned a lot from him. He got his PhD from Berkeley. And there they had a close relationship with anthropology. And they imported that idea into LSU. And the geography department at LSU is the only PhD granting geography department in the country that is a joint department. It's the Department of Geography and Anthropology. And so I went from being a spatial geographer to an economic historian of sorts to a cultural geographer, and I've never regretted the transformation. It's been a very rich period for me, and I enjoyed it very much. He differed a lot from the previous ones in that his idea of doing research was to get yourself on a pair of tough boots, get yourself a notebook and a pen, and go out in the field. At Wisconsin, when they said do field work, they meant go to the National Archives or go to the manuscript collection in North Carolina or go to LSU or someplace like that. When Fred Niffen said do field work, he meant get your can out in the field and stay there for days and days. He taught me how to look and try to understand what I saw, and for that I am grateful. Now I want to go back and talk a little bit about how hog meat and hoe cake came into being. Most of us, when we do research, we have a germ. Somebody puts a germ in your brain and it begins to eat away at your brain. Sometimes it destroys it, and sometimes it doesn't. But hog meat and hoe cake was the product of reading a paper. And I don't remember the title of the paper, but I remember the authors, and some of you know them, historians by the name of Fogel and Fishlow. And they wrote about the first part of the 19th century, and they likened the United States unto Gaul, and that is, it had three parts. There was the Northeast, there was the Midwest, and then there was the South. And the Northeast was a place where people were devoted to manufacturing, and they made manufacturing goods, and they shipped them to the South, because in the South they didn't do that. And they shipped them to the Midwest because out there, all they were interested in is growing pigs and corn and cattle and things like that. The Midwest was an agricultural region, and it provided a surplus that was shipped to the East and to the South. And of course, in the South, it was argued that it was not self-sufficient at all and couldn't feed itself. That was the word that was often used. It could not feed itself. And then the other part was the South, and that was an area that was so dominated by plantations and slavery and so obsessed with the production of a cash crop that it couldn't feed itself. So the three were linked. And the income, of course, came from the South because it had a product that was shipped overseas. And of course, all of you know that that's a super simplistic view of the whole thing, and that's what got me started. So I did a study of the South with the idea, was it really self-sufficient? Well, as you can guess, I concluded it was self-sufficient, except for a few areas where a deliberate attempt was made to import cash crops, almost exclusively along the Mississippi River, where there was a ready availability of food products. And when you stop and think about it, is that really surprising? No, it's not really surprising, because pork coming out of Cincinnati could be shipped down the river very, very cheaply. It landed on the wharves at New Orleans or stopped at Memphis or Jackson. In fact, I remember one account where the Jackson, Vicksburg to Jackson Railway hauled so many pounds of pork in a year, thereby proving that Mississippi was not self-sufficient at all. Well, we know better than that. Now, let me try a little bit of water here to try to loosen up things a little bit. There are all kind of jokes one could tell about drinking water while you're in a position like this, and I'm going to avoid them. But after all, what happened when hog meat and hockey came out? Well, in general, I guess you'd say it was accepted. But people do strange things, and they began to ask me things that at an earlier time I didn't think was very important. They wanted to know, well, what did you learn about cookbooks? And what did you learn about cooking? And what did you learn about things like that? And several people seemed to be fascinated over the fact that I had a chapter on wild foods. And this, I would say, almost amazed me. I thought I was dealing in not only in uncharted territory, but territory that nobody wanted to travel. And you can't imagine how surprised I was when people would express interest in something like eating muscadines and eating fried rabbit and poke salad. I hope you all know what poke salad is. Well, that amazed me that anybody cared about that, because I just figured that was something that, well, I did for my own pleasure. But apparently, I misjudged. There's a whole army of people out there who not only want to know about it, but they want to study it, and they love it even as much or even more than I do. So the interest with people like you began to grow, at least in my mind anyway. They began communicating to me. But another group that was emerging, and again, I was late in determining this, was anthropologists and archaeologists. Archaeology has undergone a tremendous transformation in the past two or three or four decades. Actually, it's not a very old field. Modern archaeology, which pretends to be, or at least purports to be scientific, really dates from fairly recently. The big strides were made when the excavations were made on the TVA. And a lot of the older archaeologists that I knew when I came into the field, they got their training excavating for the lakes of the TVA. But as it turns out, they're newer archaeologists, and the newer archaeologists are more interested in diet and food than the older ones were. Suddenly, food has become very important. But they find that they've made a big mistake in going through and shifting for sherds and things like that. They would use these huge nets or boxes with wire in the bottom of them. And they would sift them out, and they get little pieces of pottery, and they put the pottery together, and they do all kinds of things. Some of you are anthropologists. You know what I'm talking about. But guess what went through that? If there were any seeds in there, they would go right through it. If there were any bones in there that were not very large, they would go through too. And so I've had archaeologists tell me that they regard any archaeology done before certain dates as being extremely flawed because of that. And even where they take their samples and store them, and by the way, museums are full of these things, if you go back and redo it, you're still not going to recover what was lost in that initial dig. And I find that fascinating. And then out of this grew the new field, I consider it a relatively new field, called historical archaeology as opposed to prehistoric archaeology. And so that means that we dig at places like Monticello. By the way, did you use the word Monticello or not? Did you say Monticello or Monticello? Well, around where I grew up, there's a town by the name of Monticello, Georgia. And so after I learned about the distinction of the pronunciation, I was at Jefferson's house, and I asked one of the guides, and he had the most interesting way of describing it. When I told him about it, he said, oh, yes, so the people who work up here, we call it Monticello. So on the hill, it's Monticello. In the valley, it's Monticello. The local people call it that. I thought that was fascinating. That tells you a little something about us. But at any rate, archaeology was another place that this interest in this kind of things, and food in particular. But another source that I've noticed recently is popular writing, which is devoted more and more and more to it. Imagine my excitement when I opened the pages of Southern Living. Yes, I do look at Southern Living. And about 10 years ago, they had a map of barbecue. Did you remember that map? It was a double-page map, and it had where pork barbecue was prevalent. It had a little pig. And out in Texas, it had a cow. And I think somewhere it had chickens, and I believe in Memphis it had ribs. But the neatest part of it, and by the way, this is a cartographic stunt, the background was colored in based on the sauce. So there was a red area. Over in South Carolina, there was a yellow area over there. You know where the mustard sauce area is, North Carolina. I thought that was fascinating. But it shows that people are beginning to look, and they're beginning to taste, and they're beginning to want to know. So when you start writing about this, believe me, people are reading what you, and they believe what you say, or they're excited by what you say. Well, all of this adds up to, I guess, why we're here now, right? Now, if you recall, I concluded a long time ago that pork was the major food, meat food in the South. And it was the preferred meat beyond question in the antebellum South, and I've seen nothing since then that alters my opinion of that. In fact, the drastic growth in barbecue joints and biscuit and sausage. Have you noticed that? Biscuit and sausage. I guess when I went to Wisconsin in 1960, I don't know if anybody in Wisconsin ate biscuits. I assume they did, but at least they didn't call them biscuits. Now, if anybody was from the British Isles, they would say, oh, scone. Well, maybe a scone is a biscuit, but at any rate, it has become almost a national pastime now, and when you go into a restaurant, they will ask you, do you want toast or biscuits? That was not true 30 years ago. But there's a drastic increase. Now, I don't know if you have this impression or not, but I think barbecue has, as catfish, have become respectable in the past two or three decades. When I was a child, you could not go into a restaurant and get barbecue. Oftentimes, well, if you went on the back street, someplace on the near the railroad tracks, you might get barbecue. But more likely, you would have to go to somebody's house. It was a word of mouth, and you knew that on Thursday night he was going to cook a barbecue, so you show up that night or early the next day. If you don't, it's going to be gone. There were seedy restaurants and things like that, but I can happily report that when I retired, my home county, the county seat, Hartwell, now has a drive-in barbecue place, and its phone number, in case you're interested, is 706-376-OINK. So if you want to call them, you can get them that way. But there are no fewer than seven good barbecue places, within 5 miles of where I live now. And so that may explain a few things, I don't know. But this love of pork has always fascinated me, especially since when we look around us, it seems that America is a beef-eating nation. The hamburger, of course, accounts for a great deal of it. But pork manages to hold its own and seems to be increasing, especially in the South. And this is even more surprising when you think that when Europeans and Africans came to this country, they consumed very little meat anyway. And so once it became part of the diet, it became very, very common. The pig, as you know, was domesticated in Southeast Asia. There was no native pig. There is a native pig in the Southwest, but it wasn't found in the Southeastern United States. From Southeast Asia, it spread northward into China, became very, very common in the islands of the Pacific, where it's just basic food there. In China, the love of pork is legendary. And from that hearth area, it spread and spread fairly rapidly. Now, the method of its spreading is somewhat questionable. When it got to the Middle East, for some reason or other, it diminished importance. By the way, that's not settled yet, as I understand it, from the people who deal with things like this. Why is pork prohibited? It's supposed to be a Jewish thing, but it's not simply Jewish. It's regarded by many people as being a culture trait. But the environmentalists are into it now, with arguing very strongly that the pork is not suited to an arid environment, has no sweat glands and things like that. But I don't think that's settled yet. People are still arguing about it. But when it got to Europe, it blossomed, and it became part of the European cuisine. We think of pork when we think of German food, very openly. We think of, in Italy, pork is very common. But I might remind you that pork was eaten in Europe before the domestic pig got there, because there was a native European boar that was eaten there. But it's found all over. The French love pork, and of course made its way into Britain. And when we think of pork in continental Europe, we think of hams, we think of sausages of all kinds. And actually that's where, I guess, that area differs very much from the South. But our names for pork come from that area, such as sausage or bacon. Bacon is a term that's been used for a long time, and hams. Well, when it crossed the Atlantic, pork was in all of the colonies. But a schism seemed to occur between the northern colonies and the southern colonies. In the northern colonies, there seemed to be an emphasis on larger animals. There seemed to be an emphasis on pen-fed animals. You know, one of the advantages of pork over larger animals like cattle is that it can be kept in a very small space. They're almost a household pet in Southeast Asia, and they can be fed table scraps and all kinds of things. But by the beginning of the federal period, pork had emerged as the meat of choice in the South, especially for feeding the slaves. The standard ration became fixed, as did the standard ration for corn, and large-scale production methods were in order, but the southern planters approached it a different way. As pork was produced in Pennsylvania, the pigs were kept in pens, they were fed concentrated feed, and the trend toward a fatter hog. If you read the agricultural journals of that period in New York and Pennsylvania, and then later across the Appalachians into Ohio, there were prizes as to who could produce the biggest hog. In the South, they just turned them loose. And so open field growing of cattle and hogs prevailed over most of the South. Mild winters encouraged it. Plenty of open range, that is, if you look at the amount of cultivated land in the South, say, the first time, here's the bean counter in me coming out. In 1850, the first year we get agricultural data on fields and acreages, the amount of cultivated land was really almost insignificant, you know, like 15% or 20% or something like that. The woods were there for the taking, and the hogs actually almost became feral in the South during that time. They would have become feral, but there were too many Cajuns out there ready to kill them as quickly as they could. Actually, pigs are feral in the South. You know that. In Carolina, they're very common. In Mississippi Valley, they're fairly common. And they are not the European boar that's been introduced, although it is there, particularly in Appalachia. But in the Lowcountry of South Carolina, pigs are everywhere, and they're regularly shot for food. But at any rate, Southerners developed some interesting techniques. And one of them, I thought, which might interest you and it might not interest you, the sterilization techniques. If you're a farmer, you have to have a means of controlling breeding. In the case of cattle, you can keep the bulls and the cows apart because you have fences. In the case of hogs, if you keep them in pens, you can do the same thing. And in the case of the males, if you don't want to use them for breeding, you castrate them. Castrating is a very, very old system of controlling breeding. But if you have open range, what do you do then? Well, you can castrate your males, but suppose you miss one, or suppose one of your neighbors misses one. Well, then all of your feeder pigs are bred in the year and therefore unsuitable for pork that fall. So Southern planters, I always found this a fascinating thing, particularly after I got out in the field and I started talking to people who know how to do it. They're old enough to know how to do it and have done it. It was standard practice in the early spring to take your feeder pigs, pin them up by feeding them and enticing them in, and then you castrate all the males, but then you spay all the females. So if you miss one, all you've got is one pregnant sow. But if you did it the other way around, it would have no effect whatsoever. And then there would be a fall roundup. If you go through the census in that period of time, it's fascinating. There were so many hogs that they didn't even keep count. And you know this because when you're reading down the census, it's 50 hogs or 100 hogs or 200 hogs. Well, you know hogs don't come in 50s or 100s. It simply means that the census taker came around and the landowner said, how many hogs you got? Oh, about 200, so you put it down. Same was true, I found, of butter, too. You never find specifics. If you go to the census of Ohio, they'll tell you exactly how many pounds of butter they made. They might make, well, they made a lot. They might make 2,300. But if you go to a planter in Mississippi, they say, how much butter did you produce? And you see 50 or 100. Well, why do you think you see 50? Well, he scratches his head and he says, there are 52 weeks in a year, oh, about a week. Well, that's what it is. I made 50 pounds of butter last year. Well, that tells you that the South wasn't a dairy area for sure. But at any rate, the open range system, with its roundups in the fall, usually they use the marking the hogs with slitting their ears or something of that nature. That also goes back to the colonial period in South Carolina as well. But so pigs were easy to come by. Now you wonder where I got my data on pigs. Well, planters and farmers, more planters than farmers, kept diaries and they would keep journals and they recorded everything. After all, there wasn't a weather bureau then, so they would often record the temperature and the rainfall, but they would record the number of pounds of cotton picked. And in the fall, you'd see slaughter time come around, and they would slaughter them wholesale. They might slaughter 20 in one day, and the weights of each one would be recorded. And then 2 weeks later, they'd slaughter some more. So we know a great deal about that. And whether you call this subsistence, it was subsistence on a very large scale because a large amount of pork was needed. You also find some other interesting things which relate to some of the things that's been said earlier. You find all kinds of references to people with large land holdings running out of meat. And if you lived in Vicksburg or near the Mississippi River or near the Alabama River, you could get meat fairly easily. But what if you lived in North Georgia or in Tennessee, not near a major artery before the railroads came along? Well, you bought from your neighbors. There was a lot of interchange, and there would be small farmers and large farmers cheek by jowl, and one would trade with the other. And it happened every day. We get a glimpse of it, but we're only getting a glimpse. We're not getting the entire picture. So open range system, large numbers of hogs, explains how Southerners managed to feed their chattels and feed themselves. Up north, things were a lot different. The Cincinnati system is, of course, well known. It's been written about over and over. And Porkopolis, I guess, every graduate student learns that in his first year. And some of the accounts of Cincinnati with hog guts floating down the Ohio River are not very good to read, but they were there. There, it was a bit different. The farmers nearby, it was sort of like Cincinnati. By the way, Cincinnati was not the only area. Almost all of the towns on the Ohio River and a few going up the Mississippi River had their own slaughterhouses. Farmers from the surrounding area would grow hogs, not in huge numbers, like 200 or 300 or 400, but they would have several breeding sows, and they would feed their hogs, usually corn, and bring them to the market. And there, of course, they would be weighed as well, and they would be chopped up. The choice meats, such as the loin or the hams in particular, would be sold to be processed, but they would take the shoulders and the side meat, that is the sow belly or the part of the hog that's between, well, to put it bluntly, right here, this part of the hog. And the hog that might weigh 300 or 400 pounds, the side meat would be very, very thick, about like this. And incidentally, it was widely believed that fat meat was better for you if you were a working person. Now, I don't know whether that rumor was spread by plantation owners or not, but I've had a lot of people tell me that they believed that. They felt that they could work all day long if they had some fat meat in the morning. And I hate to admit this in front of this crowd, but I love it. There's nothing I love. You know, you can't escape where you're from, you know that? But at any rate, Midwestern system was already, it was fixed, as was said earlier, it was a commercial thing. They produced hogs to sell hogs, they standardized the procedure, and they set up transportation systems that carried it. Remember, the Erie Canal was finished in 1825. That's very, very early. So that certainly by 1830 or 40, pork and corn and wheat and all the commodities in the West moved to the Northeast by way of the Erie Canal, although a lot of the cattle and hogs were driven across the mountains, but that was a very early thing. And then a large amount of it flowed down the Mississippi River to the New Orleans out. New Orleans was opened up after the Louisiana Purchase and the boundary was settled with Britain, and it began to move in New Orleans in great, great quantities. One person I know, and several others who follow him in his thoughts, seems to think that the Midwestern model is more Germanic. That is, the Germans were notorious for fat hogs. But, you know, one of the things that created the fat hog mania was the need for lard, as an industrial raw material. It was used in soap and a number of other things. And we know for a fact that if the price of pork was fairly low, but the need for lard was fairly high, entire carcasses were rendered into lard. And so if that's the case, of course, it became an industrial raw material. But it's supposed to be a Germanic, whereas the English or Scotch, Irish, or other people in the South, they didn't come from a heritage in which fat hogs were were an idea. It's tempting. I sometimes wonder if I am living astride two eras, but I think about my childhood a lot, and I remember things that don't exist today. And I remember going into country stores, and there was always a meat box. And the meat box was twice as long as this table right here, and about twice as wide, and it was filled in the bottom for about 3 inches with salt, pure salt. And the top of it was heavy to keep out the rats and the mice and the beetles, or the skippers as they called them. But when you opened it up, there were these huge chunks of meat that were about this long, about that thick, and about this wide. They were everywhere. And you didn't find any hams in there. You didn't find any shoulders in there. You found fat meat, and that was it. And of course, we know that the same situation existed on the plantation, where the rations were kept in the provisions house, and they were issued usually weekly. But by the time I came along, the subsistence had actually declined by the time that I was a child. I would argue, and I think I'm right in this, I would say that if you're talking about self-sufficiency, the South or the individual landholding, either way you want to look at it, was more self-sufficient in 1850 than it was in 1920. And I can remember the first time I ever went through the Mississippi Delta, and that was back when sharecropping was still common, and the houses would be separated by several hundred yards, and when you drive down the back roads, you see a house here and a house there. Well, if you look in the historic records, you find that the slave kept provision plots. They kept them. But by the time I remember going through there, cotton was grown up to the back door. The only thing other than the house was the outhouse, and that was it. Where was the garden? Where was the corn? And I believe that in 1850, you would have found it there. There were some interesting studies. One of them was done at Tuskegee about this, and they came pretty much to the same conclusion. And the reason for that, of course, is that sharecropping encouraged cash crop production. And if you issue 20 acres or 30 acres, by the way, it varied depending on how many people were in the family, but if you allocated 20 acres of land to this person and says you can do with it what you want, he's going to plant a certain amount of cotton and maybe a certain amount of corn. But if he happens to get in debt and doesn't pay himself out at the end of the year, Pete Daniel was talking about that kind of thing earlier. If he got himself into debt, the temptation to plant more of the cash crop and less of the provisions was too great to ignore. So that by the time you get to the, certainly to the 1890s, and I know positively till the 1920s and 30s, the level of subsistence diminished. In fact, I would even argue, now this may be a point of departure, if you take a look at the South, particularly the lower South, and if you look at social conditions, race relations, and everything, I would say the low point was not in 1850. It was not in Reconstruction in 1870 or 80. It was in 1920 and maybe 1930 and going on into 1940. I remember very well when I'm digressing here, am I not?
You got 5 more minutes.
5 more minutes today. I remember very well. Georgia, under Herman Talmadge, passed a great number of Jim Crow laws during that period. We're not talking about 1870. We're talking about the period in my lifetime, early in my lifetime, I mind you. But we're talking about periods in my lifetime. And if I had to live under those conditions, now I don't think I'd want to be a slave, and I don't think I'd want to be living in the 1870s. But in terms of your personal well-being and your nutrition, you might have been better off in 1850 or 1880 than you would have been in 1920 or 1930, when all you saw was a little bit of cornmeal and fat meat and a gallon or two of syrup during the year, and that was it. Wow, that ought to be a point of departure, shouldn't it? But anyway, let's talk about bread. The common assumption is that the bread of choice among Southerners is cornmeal, and I would argue that up to a point. But don't forget the biscuit. It was there as well. And the very strange thing, if you think that you cook either cornbread or biscuit, you never met my mother-in-law. If she had vegetables, she had to cook cornbread, and you cook cornbread at every meal in which the vegetables are served. Stale cornbread is for the dogs. On the other hand, if you had any meat whatsoever, especially fried chicken and flour gravy and things like that, you had to cook biscuits. So most of the time I was sat down at her table, I got biscuits and cornbread. So biscuit is very Southern and cornbread is very Southern. I assume, and I think it's just a reasonable assumption, that corn was issued to slaves because it was very cheap. Throughout American history, from the very beginning, corn was the cheap cereal. In Pennsylvania, during the colonial period, people complained but that, say, in central Pennsylvania, well, not central, but in the interior part away from Philadelphia, that corn was so cheap at maybe 10 cents a bushel that it couldn't stand the transportation cost to Philadelphia, 50 miles away, whereas wheat could do it. And in the South, everybody grew corn, and if you were out of corn, it was because you had a bad year or something. It had nothing to do with your choice of buying it anywhere. It was hard to buy. And nobody grew it for profit because there was no place to sell it. Even in the Midwest, very little corn entered the trade because it was converted into some other means, either whiskey or pork or beef. Those things were together. So I would argue that biscuit or wheat flour and cornmeal were the standard in the South. But I would say this, that the typical planter might grow 100 acres of corn and he might grow 3 acres of wheat because the slaves weren't about to get any of that wheat bread. But so he only used it for his own table. In fact, I would argue that in a practical sense, in a functional sense, wheat was a garden vegetable in the South during the antebellum period. I don't think there's any doubt that corn was better adapted to the Southern environment. Wheat was domesticated in the steppes of Asia, and it did better where you had a cool winter and a very hot and wet summer. Corn loved hot and wet as well, but the American natives had had how many thousands of years to work out varieties of corn. Corn was grown in Arizona under very arid conditions. By the way, it didn't get to California, but that has to do with when the rainfall came. Throughout the Southeast, it grew very well. It grew in the delta in wet soils. It did very well on the high areas, and it did extremely well because of the climate. It requires high temperatures and a lot of moisture. It was usually milled in grist mills so that corn was almost surely and always a whole grain cereal, and roller mills didn't come along until fairly late anyway. But there are a number of things that we could talk about, but that's it, and so I want to tell you this is the confession of a reformed bean counter. Thank you.
So I have time to take, I ask you to cut short because I realize we've been running a little behind the past couple of days and really haven't had as much time as we usually do for questions. So if Sam would be willing to entertain a couple of questions, yeah.
We'll try to make them short. Yes. Oh, yeah. It varies where you are. In Louisiana, until well after World War II. In South Georgia, between World War I and World War II, they passed. In Florida, when I was in high school, I went to Florida, and the open range system was still in effect in northern Florida. Where I grew up in North Georgia, I can't remember no fence days. So it depending on where you are. I'm sure fencing was inaugurated in Virginia very early, probably in the antebellum times. But judging from Georgia, it was longer in the South, and in Louisiana, as I say, until after World War II. Generally, it was a parish or a county by county option.
Any other
questions? Yes. Oh, Lord. I'm not even sure hoe cake is cornmeal. Hoe cake is most anything. To my mother, hoe cake was you make the biscuits, and you don't touch biscuits but one time. You know, you roll them out, and you cut them, and you pick them up, and don't you dare knead them the second time. What was left over after you cut them like this, you take that, you knead it, you make it in a patty, and you cook it separately, and that's what I ate as hoe cake. Counts vary, but hoe cake was also corn, and sometimes it was corn and flour, wheat flour mixed. But it, well, that's where the term comes from, but having used a hoe in my life, I'd starve to death eating things. You know, a blade of a hoe is about like, well, actually, the old slave hoes were a little bigger. But, yeah, that's good. But it's changed so much in time, I would think. But to me, it's wheat flour. In the old days, it was corn, and it was probably intermixed. Yes, ma'am? Well, my mother-in-law cooked like that. She never baked bread. She had fried cornbread. And actually, most of the African-American homes that as a child, I ate there a lot of times. And it was almost always fried. It was almost always fried. Just like turnip greens were almost always made in a frying pan. They weren't boiled. They were fried in a pan and rolled over, actually almost as if, I don't know, it's hard to imagine frying greens, but that's what I ate when I visited. They had to chase me off, of course.
Thank you,
Dr. So I turned the mic over to Mussolini.